Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Episode 4 of New Scientist, 24th of November 2018. This next article is called Hunting the Ghost Particle, and that typically refers to this something called the sterile neutrino. I think so. So a neutrino is a particle which really interacts with nothing, but it's required to produce it. I think it is a lepton. Yeah, there's... So a lepton, it's like an electron, but it's a component of electron which gets produced to allow you to create an electron. So you can create a neutrino, so a lepton, an anti-lepton, an antiparticle, and this is the antiparticle of the electron. So it's involved in beta decay, first proposed in beta decay. And the other neutrinos are associated with the three levels. There's three types of electrons, the electron, the muon, the tau electron, all different types of electron, different heavy weights, and there's neutrinos with one, each of those. The sterile neutrino, as far as I know, is a wild child, so I don't know what they're going to talk about. So, to fix the fundamental physics, we may need to raise the sterile neutrino from the dead. Oh my god, I could tell that. Okay, this is a story of a particle that has refused to die. Well, I think so. It's 50 years, it's haunted physics, particle physics, with hints of its presence appearing in manly, ambiguous ways. Some believe they may have seen it, others think it's a figment of our imagination. But every time we think it's definitely not there, a sudden gust of wind knocks over the furniture, and once more there's room for doubt. Elusive though it is, the sterile neutrino would be a real boon. It could make sense of experimental anomalies stretching back for decades, and gives us the first confirmed glimpse of physics beyond what we know. Oh dear, i.e. that we're perfectly okay without it. And, I mean, physics for decades, I think... anomalous physics result, more than 5 years old, is pretty hard to think about. It could even explain the strangely low masses of ordinary neutrinos, as well as offering a convincing candidate for dark matter. Oh, well, that's, I'll grant you that. I can't see... Yeah, neutrinos have incredibly low masses, so this hypercharge for the Higgs field. The bad news is that the latest round of experiments set up for it claim that it can't possibly be there. Some physicists think that's the end of the story, others still believe in a mystery particle, but conclude it is. Yeah, so physics, sterile neutrinos, how to get yourself unloved. Nothing like we imagined. However, for some, the combination of experimental uncertainties and flawed analysis means that maybe, just maybe, the sterile neutrino could be alive and kicking after all. The problem starts with the neutrino bit. Neutrinos are notoriously hard to pin down. They have no charge, almost no mass, and can pass through matter by the millions without leaving a trace. So that is, a neutrino can easily go through the Earth. I think it's got a cross-section of a light year of lead before it hits something. First inkling that we were out... we had that they were out came in 1930 when physicist Wolfgang Pauli was struggling to make sense of the decay of certain radioactive atoms. Atoms consist of a nucleus made of protons and neutrons orbited by much lighter electrons. Oh, I don't like the way they say orbit. Okay, when an atomic nucleus undergoes beta decay, that is, it pushes out an electron, it morphs into daughter nucleus, emitting an electron in the process. The problem perplexing Pauli was that the two decay products went in directions that seemed to violate and cast the iron law of conservation of momentum, suggesting a third particle was needed to make sense of the results. That's more energy, I think, he was looking at. The tiny chargeless particle Pauli dreamed up and subsequently called the neutrino, and it was spotted in the wild in 1956. That's a fair number of years. Over the following decades, experimental years gradually worked out that neutrinos can come in multiple types of flavors. Ooh. The They were in neutrinos that Pauli had predicted with an intimate connection with the electron, but these were similar relationships with the electron's heavy cousins, the muon and the tau. These three neutrinos neatly slotted into the standard model of the grand blueprint of particle physics, and that appeared to be that. Now, that's interesting about how you've got neutrinos' masses and flicking out. But neutrinos were only getting started. As it happens, a massive source of neutrinos is right next door in cosmic terms. The Sun is a nuclear fusion reactor, powered by beta decay, and pumps out an electron and neutrinos by the billions, some of which come our way, passing through the Earth on their journey out into the wider universe. It's as long ago as 1916, however, physicists measuring the quantity of electron neutrinos reaching Earth found a major shortfall, with one experiment detecting only 25% of the expected number. And this is what I thought would be a great one. Now, let's listen to Solving the Mystery. Solving the Mystery involved conceding the standard model of particle physics, which had guided the fields for decades, was incomplete. Rather than being massless, each neutrino did have a tiny amount of mass, no more than a millionth of that of an electron. Mass gives the neutrinos a remarkable ability to switch flavors, morphing from one into another as they zoom along, a process called neutrino oscillation. Now, that's sort of hard to believe, isn't it? A neutrino can oscillate, but I suppose it's a low mass anyway. So a electron neutrino can go into a tor and a thing. This meant that neutrinos produced the sun's core could transform to either muon or tor neutrinos, evading our searches on Earth. Now, this is, so if it's going, if it's in a tor neutrino, it's got to hit off a tor particle. If we had not realized this could happen, then we would never have been able to figure out what was going on, they said. And that is amazing. How something can oscillate. What on earth is that all about? I'm a physicist, but that, my friends, is just stunning amazing. So I throw a particle fast enough, and if it's got a tiny mass, it can morph. Not from an electron can't morph into a tor. That's a huge mass away, but there must be all pretty massless. Conrad, an experimental physicist. Oh, how does that go there? Oh, it says Janet. Oh, she'd be an interesting person to chat to. Conrad, an experimental physicist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Granting, we have to mention a quote and a mention of someone. Granting neutrinos the ability to transform into another solved their solar neutrino problem, but another mysteries remained. The most fixing of these date from the 1990s when experimentalists called Liquid Scintillator Neutrino Detector in Los Alamos, Mexico, found that an antimatter version of the muon neutrinos were oscillating into electron antineutrinos faster than expected. Okay, so there's nothing unusual. If you make a matter electron, it's an antimatter. They're all normal. I don't understand what's the... all neutrinos, most of the neutrinos come from reductions of electrons, and therefore, because electrons are matter, they're able to be antimatter. The result was confirmed by a second experiment, Mini Boonie, which ran in Fermilab at Batavia, Illinois, from 2002 to 2017. That's going to be really fascinating, Fermilab. What's that? What is happening there? Either the experiments were both plagued by experimental downfall or something deeper was going on. The LNS Mini Boonie anomaly is a genuine mystery, says Raymond Volkus of the University. I know, Ray Volkus. He used to be my tutor at university. That's pretty amazing. Another set of confounding results come from radioactive decays within nuclear reactors. Like the sun, these decays are a strong source of neutrinos. For some unexplained reason, though, nuclear reactors on Earth appear to produce about 6% fewer electron antineutrinos than the standard model predicts. So, too many antineutrinos being produced on one hand and not enough on the other. What's going on? I haven't quite understood that. Oh, well, I'm a bit slow. You in podcast land can possibly understand. That's where the sterile neutrino comes in. Instead of a neat trio of neutrinos, the idea is to invent a fourth sterile flavor of neutrino capable of shape-shifting into the other three. This seems a big deal given that the notion of generations is deeply rooted in flavors. How dare you say, oh, no, flavors across, you know, you up, down, quark is the generation of flavor. So I don't think it's correct to talk about flavors of neutrinos. Let's have a look. Matter increasing. Oh, I don't know why this. John's charge. Quarks come in flavors, and then there's generations. I don't quite understand what they're going on. It's deeply backed into the same model. See the chart below left. But with the neutron, reasons for this magic number is still a mystery. Inventing a whole new generation of particles, or even assuming the steron alone is a lone misfit, might be no more puzzling. All right, okay, that's a good way of putting it. It's just, it's a neat, well, it's 4x4, I suppose. You know, so there could be yet another generation. I think it's going to be difficult. Unlike its siblings, though, which interact through a weak nuclear force, steron neutrons would only feel a pull of gravity. The idea was first proposed in 1958 by Italian nuclear physicist Bruno Pontefercco as a way to allow neutrinos to morph into anti-neutrinos. Okay, I'm a bit concerned about that. And how it couldn't... what is a neutrino which doesn't interact with the weak nuclear force? I suppose it's a whole new area to look at. But the sterility is possible as of his proposed particle meant it would almost be impossible to detect. Interest rapidly waned until the anomalies revived it. The logic goes that the mini Bunny and the LSND saw more electron neutrinos than predicted because of all the extra steron neutrinos that decayed into this kind. The reason for reactor experiments saw all those electron neutrinos go missing was because they had decayed into their sterile counterpart. Genius. Okay. Summoning the sterile neutrino into existence would exercise a number of other problems as well. Neutrino masses are tiny, over millions of times smaller than the next lightest particle, the electron. The reason for this gap is unknown, but a heavier fourth neutrino would offer a solution. By a process known as seesaw mechanism, its increased mass could drive the masses of the others down, like toddlers going up and down a seesaw. Yeah, okay, that's not necessarily a good analogy. It tells you a bit. Same particles have also been proposed The same particle has also been proposed as a plausible candidate for dark matter, the mysterious stuff known to make up 27% of the universe. Others say the sterile neutrinos could also solve the question of why antimatter produced in equal quantities to matter at the start of the universe is now all but vanished. If so, the three puzzles of modern physics would finally be an explanation in one theory, said Ole Rochny, the University of Copenhagen, Denmark. Unless nothing involving neutrinos is ever simple. And well, that's not really a sensible statement. Fridge experiment suggesting hints of a sterile neutrino, there's another offering evidence that it does not exist. The most emphatic is the universe itself, the present day arrangement of stars and galaxies, and the faint surviving echoes of the Big Bang. Oh well, don't let that stop you. And there's a little byline I have to read. The Secret Life of Muons. I love muons. They're just really sexy. Okay, if sterile neutrinos had existed throughout the universe history, says Volkes Ray, good old Ray, then their presence would have caused the cosmos to look different than it is currently does. What's more, the reactor anomaly has recently been called into question. Several experiments now underway have put the neutrino detectors closer to the nuclear reactor than before. Now, for a more accurate measurement, the electron neutrino of the electron antineutrino disappearance. Gee, that hurts me reading. Although this analysis of the data is not yet sufficiently advanced to say anything for certain, preliminary results suggest the anomaly might have disappeared. Mini Boo's latest results, released earlier this year, muddied the water still further. They showed a larger anomaly than before. Some hail this as a strong evidence for the existence of the hypothetical particle. But if the sterile neutrino exists, then the muon neutrinos shouldn't just transform into electron neutrinos on their way to the detector. Some should disappear as well. Yet muon neutrinos' disappearance has never been seen. The recently strengthening of Minibu anomaly actually makes the situation worse, because the stronger the appearance of the signal implies a stronger disappearance of the signal as well. During the 15 years Minibuni was ticking away, physicists set up a number of smaller experiments to probe for the disappearance explicitly. One of the biggest is called Minos Plus, based in Fermilab. Over the 10 years it had, and its predecessor have been running, muon neutrinos have steadfastly refused to vanish. This places severe limits on what any potential sterile neutrino may look like, or even exist. So they've got to have, to make muon neutrinos, they've got to have a source of muons. So I don't know how they do it. Is that the muons? There's muons produced by the bucket load. That's because of cosmic rays. It'd be interesting to know how that works. For all the stakes hammered through the sterile neutrino's heart, it still keeps slumbering on. Conrad says the experiments that conform to our expectations, like Minos Plus, historically receive less scrutiny than those like LSD and Minibuni, which show signals we're not expecting. Limits always get less scrutiny than anomalies. Ghostbusters. The time, however, someone has stepped up to do scrutinizing. Bill Lewis, a physicist at Fermilab, combed through the results of Minos Plus and how the team analyzed them. The Minos Plus collaboration has worked very hard on data analysis, says Lewis. He stresses the quality of the experiment and the complexity of the mathematics involved. That being said, he believes the errors in the data may have been overlooked, leading the team to rule out disappearances with greater certainty than is warranted. More recent paper by Minos Plus has been waiting publication for October last year, held up because of the issues, including those raised by Lewis, said Conrad. Bill only touches about half the obvious problems, she says. Okay. Carol Lang, a spokesperson for Minos and Minos Plus collaboration, says the team has been in contact with Lewis and others while auditing and dissecting results for better explanation to underlying trends and resulting constraints on the and the resulting constraints on the sterile neutrino. So where do things stand? The result from Minibu, Ni, and Minus Plus survived further scrutiny, then sterile neutrinos on its own is not just going to cut it. We need something else to help explain why the same particle causes both muon and electron neutrinos to appear, but only electron neutrinos to vanish. So there's three types of neutrinos for every type of lepton. Yeah, well, leptons are electrons and neutrinos. So I wonder what you call the... So there's just chargeless electrons, which are the neutrinos. It's just very messy. I think Ray Valkis was nice speaking to them. The experiments, like Minibu, search for neutrino oscillations. The nature of the oscillation depends on the energy of the neutrinos observed at the detector. But neutrinos can interact with other particles on their way, changing their energy. We assume most neutrinos are interacting with free neutrinos in the atomic... free neutrons in the atomic nuclei. What's the free neutron? Okay. But some neutrinos can hit neutron-proton pair instead, and this changes the amount of energy they have. Conrad says we don't fully understand this effect yet, so analysis could be made to look like there are oscillations when there aren't. If this is the case, we might not need a sterile neutrino at all, just improved calculations. However, says Conrad, such effect could be working in the other direction, shielding sterile neutrinos and signals that would otherwise be much stronger. This could be enough to rescue this sterile neutrino from the deathbed, she says. Okay, I must admit, I don't really know enough to judge either way, but just it's just such a big ask. While theorists develop ever more exotic ideas about what could be out there, experimentalists seem to keep on searching. Using detectors around the world, from Russia, the UK, and even under the Arctic ice, they hope to place even higher bounds on the disappearance of muons and electron neutrinos, well as the rate at which one turns to the other. Whether these experiments wind up discounting previous results or backing them up is yet to be seen. But it's an exciting time. Volkus, Ray Volkus, you chap, how are you still going? Believes current experiments could provide definite answer to those questions within the next few years. If Liz's hunch is right, the zombie particle could rise from the grave once again. So I don't think we have to worry very much about that. Now let's read the byline here. And 8:28. The secret life of muons. So you've got the electron, and when a cosmic ray hits an electron, it can produce muons and even tau. The muon lasts for a little while, so it can shower down on us. Neutrinos have always been the black sheep of the particle family. Why would you say that? They come from in three flavors, each associated with generations, I suppose, flavors, each associated with heavier cousins called the electron. Muon and tau. These heavier particles were long thought to be well behaved, but now it seems the muon may have a dirty secret. Oh, that's interesting. In 2001, an experiment at Brookhaven Lab, New York, measured the quantum property of a particle known as the magnetic moment, and found that it exceeded the theoretical predictions. But it normally does because it's, it's the base one due to interacting with virtual particles. Now, this could have been a statistical fluke, but we have still a better idea once more sensitive experiments start collecting the data in February next year. Meanwhile, experiments at Large Hadron Collider near Geneva have also seen muons behaving oddly. Decay of particles known as B mesons should produce muons in roughly the same quantities as electrons. So a B meson is a quark antiquark pair. So a meson. Okay, so it can be charged. So this hadron is made out of three quarks. This is made out of a quark antiquark pair. I suppose there's interesting parallels with the fact that muon neutrinos don't disappear as often as the electron neutrinos do. A major problem for neutrino physics, the two anomalies could be connected, says Sabine Holzenfelder, a theoretical physicist at the Frankfurt Institute for Advanced Studies in Germany. You get the impression that we are missing something here, but no one has a clear idea what we are missing, she says. It's a fascinating and exciting. Oh, there's a good old Sabina out there. So the Germans pronounce the last E. So we call it Sabine. But the Germans pronounce the last E in Sabina. Okay. Well, that's fascinating to know that there's still some mysteries out there. I was absolutely sure there was something weird, totally weird going in the sun. Like a third of neutrinos coming out. That's pretty crazy. Access all areas. An audacious plan to make research freely available could transform science as we know it. Graham Lawton. I think everyone's happy grounds talking about this. As scientific wages go, Lenny Tremans isn't up there with the gate. So it doesn't have the celebrity appeal of Stephen Hawking's bet on black holes or the intrigue of the wager between Christoph Koch and David Chalmers on consciousness. But the outcome will, arguably, have a greater impact than any of them. In February last year, Telemann bet $100 that by January 2030, all biomedical researchers will be published in an open access journal. In other words, be freely available to read as soon as it's in print. No subscription, no paywall, no restrictions ever. This may sound like the beginning of a tedious story of interest only academics and publishers. I suspect so too when I started looking into it. But I soon discovered I was wrong. the Battle of... That's an interesting way they go. And this is an interesting story because look how many pages... There's no quote on the first page. But they have mentioned people and wage, so it's slightly different, let's see. The battle is... The battle over scientific publishing is a tale of big money, piracy, hacking, infighting, fake news, and free speech. At stake is the soul of science itself. After bubbling away for 20 years, it's about to boil over with the unpredictable consequences for all of us. Lovely use of concepts there. To understand what's going on, it's helpful to hark back to the late 1990s when the notorious website called Napster was spreading panic throughout the music industry. Napster and its many imitators were in the business of music piracy. Their technology allowed people to access the playlists on each other's computers, making almost any freely available to anyone with the internet connection. The industry rightly regarded it as a criminal existential threat and sued Napster. The site was shut down in 2001. However, it is credited with forcing the industry to rethink their business model by impressing legal digital download stores such as iTunes, and eventually subscription-based streaming such as Spotify. Today, scholarly publication is facing its own Napster in the shape of a website called Sci-Hub, which lets anybody download almost any academic paper free of charge. There is an awful lot of research out there, and according to a recent estimate, it runs to 2.5 million papers each year, and rising. Most are published by traditional publishing houses are available, legally only with a subscription and the payment of a one-off fee. Neither option is cheap. For instance, the annual subscription to Biophysica Acta, requires a reading for biochemists and biophysicists. Costs, £4,574. Access to a single research paper is likely to cost £30 or more. This all adds up to a very lucrative business. In 2013, academic publishers generated globally revenues of $25 billion. That's enough to send a space probe back. Profit margins are reported between 30 and 40%, and figures it's hard to verify, although not disputed by the industry's leading trade body, the International Association of Scientific, Technical and Medical Publishers. Indeed, last year, Elsevier, I hate those people, the world's largest academic publisher, reportedly profit margin of nearly 37%, amounting to £91.3 million. In other words, academic publishing is one of the world's most profitable businesses in the world. It's also one of the most controversial because it's built on the privatization of assets created by public money and free labor. Here's how it works. Research funders receive taxpayers' money, which they dole out to scientists who they submit their findings to journals in an attempt to get them published. If a subscription journal accepts the paper, usually on the recommendation of peer reviewers who aren't paid for their work, it publishes them and charges people to read it. Taxpayers often pay out the charges too. For example, see if they're going to start quoting here. They can't help but write an article but quote. Okay, some length of article here. When a university library buys a subscription, that is, if they can afford the many to many universities, even in the US, lack the resources to buy all the journals that the scientists need to keep up with their fields, says Tillerman. It's an absurd situation. That is really bad. Sci-Hub was set up in 2011 as a direct, although illegal, challenge to the status quo. Since then, its founder, Kazakhistani graduate student, hacker and activist Alexandria Caliban have begged, borrowed and stolen millions of paywalled research papers. Sci-Hub's technology isn't the same as Napster, but its effect is. Sci-Hub claims to have 70 million papers in its repository and growing. Accessing them is simple. You just input the web address or digital identifier of the paper you want. Both are easy to discover, according to Elkerman. Last year, there were 150 million downloads, with users in China and India leading the way. SciHub is paying legal cut and cat and mouse as academic publishing industry tries to take it down. Elsevier and American Chemical Society have won lawsuits against it. Elban is in hiding to avoid extradition. Oh, God. And, of course, SciHub isn't an alternative to the traditional way of publishing research because it doesn't produce any papers itself. Nevertheless, like Napster before, it may be a catalyst that changes how the industry works. In fact, a small group of David and Goliath began fighting the Goliaths of the academic publishing 2 decades ago. They argue that traditional subscription model undermines the one of the accepted norms of science, openness. Scientific progress depends on open communication, so research should be locked behind paywalls. They have shed blood, sweat, and tears to invent a new way of publishing openly while still covering the cost. Open access comes in various forms, see the many faces of openness left. But they all have one thing in common. A paper can be read for free by anyone, anywhere. From small beginnings in the 1990s, open access publishing has grown into a thriving industry. The director of Open Access Journals lists more than 12,000 quality peer-reviewed journals from 62 publishers, including pioneers such as the Public Library of Science, PLOS, and eLife, as well as traditional... It's getting a bit... Light's fading here, so it's a bit hard to read. Publishing powerhouses as Sage, Wiley, Springer, Nature. Veteran publishers are increasingly flipping their business models from subscribers to open access, or at least a mixture of both. What's more, many open access publishers make decent living, not from subscriptions and paywalls, but from charging authors a fee for publishing their papers. The highly respected PLOS Biology, for example, charges $3,000. Nobody's arguing that publishing should be free. It does cost a lot, and you need a source of revenue to cover the expenses, says Tillerman, who is CEO and Protocols IO, an open access repository of experimental methods in life science. On the other hand, the aim isn't to make big profits. In fact, both PLS and eLife register losses in their most recent financial reports. In addition, although open access journalists still rely on unpaid peer reviews, many academics see this as part of their duty, and they feel less exploited working to open access publishers. Admittedly, some scientists are very wary of this model too, arguing that high publication fees creates inequalities. That removes barriers for reading, but creates barriers for publishing, says Lynn Kramer, the biochemist at Uppsala University in Sweden. I like that. She leads a growing campaign and group supporting open science in principle, but concerned about its practice. Getting published should be about the quality of your research, not about the size of your wallet, she says. Some open access publishers make a living by publishing large volumes of mediocre papers that should, I would agree with that. Concern us all, she adds. We're living in a world where we're having a big problem with fake news. The problem in academic publishing, there's a problem, but we have do have systems that checks and balances and get quizzes on how information is disseminated. Free for all. Advocates of open access pointed out that these journals have essentially the same quality controls as traditional ones, including reputation and impact factors, which measure how frequently the average paper is cited in a year. But there is another problem with open access as they see it. The original ambition was to be totally replace traditional publishing, and that was far from happening. Quote, most researchers still publish in subscription journals, says Tillerman. In 2016, just 15% of journals were pure open access. 38% were pure toll access. Most recent hybrid journals, subscription journals that will also publish papers as open access for a fee, these hybrid models is the bugbear of openness purists who argue that it gives traditional publishers two bites of the cherry, so no incentive to fully embrace the open access. Perhaps surprisingly, traditional publishers are quick to profess admiration for open access. We're highly supportive of all forms of sustainable open access, says Mark McKay of the International Association of Scientific Technical Medical Publishers. We're aiming for as much open access as possible. So why hasn't it happened? In this case, it is a case of, quote, please God, make me good, but not just yet. Question, is it a case? When I put this to McKay, he replied that what may look like stalling is actually an attempt to engineer an orderly transition. There are risks associated with flipping to open access, he says, not the least preserving the integrity and continuity of the scholarly record. That will not be aided by a transition which is badly executed or journals that go bust. I don't see any real disagreements on whether open access is a good thing or a bad thing. The key differences are over how we get from A to B, says McKay. The last bid to break the logjam came in early September when a group of 12 European research funders delivered what they hoped would be a decisive shock to the system. As it, from the January 2020, any research they pay for must be published in an open access journal. Subscription publishing will be totally banned, including the hybrid journals, but beyond that the details are negotiable. We do not advocate any particular open publication model. The research communities can take over the design of publication models that fit their needs best, says Mark Schultz, president of Science Europe, an umbrella organisation of science funders, including a group of 12 that signed up to the move. The group calls it the Coalition S, where OA stands for Open Access and S for Science, Speed, Solution, Shock. According to Schultz, it's a working title and it's kind of stuck, he adds. Between them, they have control of more than $18 billion of annual research funding, and the coalition is growing. The Wellcome Trust has said it will implement the plan. Two more European funders will also join in, and according to Schultz, there is interest from many Science of Europe's 29 other members and from research funders worldwide. This looks potentially transformative. It took 20 years to get one funder to commit to immediate open access, the Gates Foundation. And so, suddenly, to get 12 more is quite an outcome. This is, I'm sure the other bodies will join in. What if they don't, though? The worry is, one reason the plan hasn't been met with universal acclaim. If funders in the US and Asia won't follow suit, it would create disadvantages for European researchers by locking their work out of prestigious journals such as Nature and Science. Some members of Science Europe may also demur, leading to balkanization of the European research landscape. But if that happens, the journals stand to lose too. The Coalition S is gambling on the publishers will blink first. This is basically a line in the sand. If you don't flip to open access, you're going to lose output from our grantees. And if you reject top research, you can't be a top journal. Your impact factor will slide and your brand will be damaged. Not everyone is convinced. Kellerman and her campaign group dislike the ban on hybrid publishing, which they say will exclude them from some of the most prestigious journals in their field, and so restrict their academic equality and freedom. She's also nervous about the assumption that the research communities will come up with a new model to make this work. It's a shove into the unknown, she says. Perhaps it's a shove, it's the shove that's what's needed. Everyone, whatever their position, agrees that flipping to open access is the right thing to do. Benefits will go far beyond science and publishing. Most people are not researchers, but they care about things like advances in medicine and technology. A lot of the public policies depend on evidence that are turned up, our researchers, says Peter Suber of Harvard University, a leading expert in open access publishing. Open access helps researchers do their work, and so helps the benefits that flow from research. Tillman agrees, quote, at this point, coming out and saying that subscription publishing is good for society is a bit like saying smoking is good for you. I know who you'll be rooting for to win the £100. Thanks a lot. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.